We now move from the bubble of the elites to the turf of the regular voter. You may ask, why not have a Stop the Stealer on the show? Well, the clips we've played earlier this hour may explain why not. We're not after a gotcha, a shouting match, or a snicker. And a genuine exchange of ideas isn't possible on this issue. There was no steal. But we were after someone who knows that turf, so we asked Osted Herndon, who covers national politics for the New York Times and regularly visits Trump rallies and similar events. He says he'd rather speak with voters who believe the election myth than with the politicians who foster it.
Frankly, I think talking to elected officials gets you a spin. That's only one piece of the puzzle, and I really focus on the other half.
Right, but there's also the access issue. I mean, they're not going to answer your calls, are they?
Yeah, for a Republican politician right now, if you are someone who really aligns with that kind of Trump ideology, the New York Times doesn't really serve your purpose. Your main voters aren't reading it. And more than that, you're rewarded for taking an active stance against it.
You said that you found it easier to speak with voters. Why don't you tell me about your visit to Virginia ahead of the governor's race in October?
I went to Virginia for a couple things. You know, there's been much talked about how the Republican nominee there, now the governor, Glenn Youngkin, was kind of towing the line between a Trump Republican and a regular Republican. And when I went to these events, that's not really a line that's real. It's become a litmus test for candidates. They really have to prove themselves to the base. And so while Youngkin did say publicly that he would have voted to certify the election, Sarah gets sent signals to the base to say, hey, you can still trust us. That is what is being communicated in that Trump media ecosystem. So you have a Republican who's then both able to have their cake and eat it too. They can tell media and the elected class that they would not follow Donald Trump down that path of election conspiracy, while at the same time, they're telling the actual voters that they would have.
And this is why we wanted to call you to talk about strategy in a way, because you're talking about people who think that they've outsmarted the system. They don't have to believe what they see. The system is a fraud. Everyone in it is a fraud. Your guy is a better fraud than all the other frauds, and he is your guy on your side. How do you interview people like that?
In the same way I try to interview all voters, be transparent and honest about what I'm up to. People want to ask about what the article's about. I'll give them the general thoughts about the premise. I'll hear if they think that the premise is wrong and say that that's something that we would love to include in the story. Hey, if your beef with media is that we don't come to places like here and reflect the voices of people like you, I am here. What is the perspective that you think we are missing? Tell me right now. I'll put it in the paper.
You are there, a black man from the New York Times. How are you received?
I think it's a mixed bag. Certainly, race and blackness comes up. I'm 28. I'm kind of visibly like a kid, and people bring up age all the time. I mean, and there are certain ways that I think being Midwestern, growing up outside of the window of coastal Washington, is actually helpful for me at these things. And so I think that actually all of those identities come into play. But I got to say, a lot of people ask me about race and Trump rallies, but my race is brought up at liberal events. I've had Democrats talk to me about blackness. Bernie Sanders supporters tried to absolve what they were doing in the civil rights movement by telling me what they're doing. So I really think that I try to take the same approach with those voters as I do with everyone. Come at them directly, come at them honestly, and cross your fingers.
As you've described it, interviewing Trump supporters seems pretty similar to interviewing any political cohort. But are there any differences?
Yeah. You cannot assume that the national or mainstream conversation is the topic of discussion there. If you are in that interaction and you don't know what they're talking about, if you don't speak the language, they're not going to really want to talk to you. That you should stay a little longer than someone expects. People like when you kind of hang with them for a little bit. I like to find people individually as they're walking up to the rally, as they're getting a concession. I find that people are more willing to talk to you individually than when it's in a group or big setting. I remember asking a woman at that Virginia rally, what is it about Trump supporters that she doesn't think the rest of the country knows that she wants to tell them? And what she said was, I really think the election was stolen. When you are there, that is the topic of discussion.
The reason why we're talking about Trump at these rallies where Trump was not running is that it was your observation that he was running. in a sense.
You cannot exist as a Republican without constantly thinking, what does Donald Trump do or think about this? In my view, that still means that he is the leader of that party and cannot be ignored. Private citizens can still have power, and he has a lot of it.
I was just surprised in the piece that, at least in the group that you were reporting on there, it was much more about Trump than it was about the candidate Youngkin.
You know, the phrase used to be that all politics was local. We are seeing a politics that's increasingly national, and Donald Trump is the center of that. And so for these people at this rally, they saw Virginia as the first step to reclaiming a country that they think has an illegitimate president. This was the first step in a larger process, not the end.
You batted me away a little bit before when I was talking about you being in this group in which there's a great concern that their country is being taken from them. And though you certainly, I'm sure, have had awkward and microaggressive moments with white liberals, I wondered whether the experience was different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I shouldn't downplay it. I mean, I'm going to give you the caveats before I actually answer you.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell so many stories about micro and macro aggression, but I worry about people feeling a little too good about themselves.
Right.
That it's those type of people and not others. So, having said that, I was in Texas on the day Biden was announced and the man called black protesters the N-word. Mm. I was in Arizona where someone called me and Barack Obama an N-word. In Arizona at Trump Fest, a person put a gun on the table and said that he planned to do violence if Donald Trump did not win the election. This was someone who actually ended up going to the Capitol on the 6th. I was kicked out of a bar in Pennsylvania. You know, I could tell a lot of those stories when I was writing about crime in Boston, too. People saying a lot of wild stuff or kicking me out of places. Often I'm doing work that inserts yourself into really traumatic moments for people and really high intensity moments. It's actually kind of logical to be really skeptical of someone showing up out of the random and asking you to tell all your political thoughts or stepping into the worst day of your life and asking you to tell millions of people about it. I think they should talk to me, and I'm going to make the case of them of why they should. But I respect people's no's, too.
There's been a lot of pearl clutching about giving a platform to the big lie. Do you think it's important to interview people who espouse those views?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's the core of really understanding how politics is working right now.
But it doesn't tell you how it works. It just tells you that it did work.
I'm making a smaller distinction in that. People thinking that politics is a debate class that only deals with what is true has actually stopped people from seeing the spread of certain political movements in the country over the last 5 to 10 years. And so I think if we had a media ecosystem that understood how birtherism was more widespread than we ever admitted, then we would have understood the 2016 election and the 2016 Republican primary a lot more. I really think that in the current tech environment, in the media environment, and how politics is working, you can't run from this. That does not make it true, and you need to note in your stories that it's not true. You need to find ways to do it responsibly, but I don't think that ignoring it's an option.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Astead W. Herndon is a reporter covering national politics for the New York Times. Coming up, the truth sandwich. Can there ever be enough of them? This is On the Media.